When we last talked to Con Hundley, we left him at the village barn, so we're going to go back and get him. Con, can you tell me, was it rowdy at these village barn concerts? Did you get hecklers?
No, we didn't get much heckling. And it was rowdy. I mean, it was country, and it was Saturday night, and there was guys that worked hard during the week and all that stuff, and they came to let their hair down. But seldom ever did anything spill over and get, you know, like fights and all that stuff. Everybody's pretty respectful, and everybody was there just to have a good time. And there was always kind of, there was what they call security around, and so they didn't let it get out of hand. But it was kind of a rowdy place. We had a good time. I remember Sam saying one time to the band, he said, if y'all are playing and you hear metal chairs, a loud wrangling of metal chairs, he said, play something fast and loud, because it was like there was some trouble. So we'll try to cover it, but it didn't happen that often. But I was there, you know, like I said, from, I think I started there in 1970, and I left there in late 78. So,
I mean, you were certainly good enough to get signed to a major label at any point during that 10 years, but do you think delaying that in some way helped you?
I do. I do. Number one, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And of course, I mean, I lived off of what I made, you know, which, and it wasn't very much. I lived in a trailer out in Halls, you know, and it was $120 a month, and some months I had trouble making the $120, and I was eating beanie weenies up, pork and beans, and whatever I could to survive. And I think the experience helped me quite a bit. It taught me a little bit about human nature, taught me how to approach playing and singing. It taught me that not everybody's interested in your singing. Look, find somebody in the audience that is, and sing to that person. Don't get upset if while you're singing somebody gets up and walks out or walks off or whatever, because you got to consider the other people there, you know. So I think it was a great experience. And from a chronological standpoint, it might have been better had I, you know, gotten a deal a little earlier. But 31, you know, now sounds pretty young. So I finally got a deal in 1977. I guess it'd be closer to 32 with the Warner Brothers.
How was it living out in Halls in a trailer? What were those days like?
I had a friend of mine. His name was Earl Glenn, and he owned a dry cleaning place. So his insurance guy was in there one day, and I was down there. And, of course, Earl always gave me a break on my dry cleaning, and sometimes if I didn't have the money, he'd just do it for nothing, you know, because we were good friends. We played golf occasionally when I could afford it. But I'm down there one day, and his insurance agent was there. And so his insurance agent wanted to talk to me about life insurance, and I said, life insurance? Are you kidding? I said, I can barely afford to live, let alone buy insurance on something that I can barely afford, you know? So anyway, it kind of went on and on. So a couple of weeks later, the Piggly Wiggly out in Halls had a baby beef sale. Okay. And so when I lived in this trailer, it was just me and this big old Persian cat, and he was mean, he chased dogs. That's how mean he was. So, you know, between taking care of myself and trying to feed the cat, it was a stretch. But anyway, so the Piggly Wiggly out here had a baby beef sale, so I go out there and buy a couple of little baby beef T-bones. I hadn't had a steak in so long, I couldn't wait, you know. So I got them, and I put the baked potatoes in the oven and let them bake. And then I got the steaks, got them all lathered up, and put them in the oven. Didn't have a grill or anything, so I did them in the oven. And I just gotten the steaks out, and I set them on the table. Here's this knock on the door. I thought, oh, my God, I'm done to eat this steak, you know. So I go to the door. It's this insurance man from the dry cleaners. He said, Con, he said, I wanted to come by. Earl told me to come by and see. He said, I wanted to come by. I said, there's a little clause in this, one of the new policies. He said, I think you'll be able to afford it. And I said, if you don't mind, I said, I'm just fixing to sit down to eat. If you'd wait and just come back maybe 10 or 15 minutes or even tomorrow, if it's okay. He said, look, it won't take me 5 minutes. I said, okay, come on in. So we're standing just inside the front door, and he's making his spiel. And all of a sudden, I hear, and I turn around and look. And Felix, this big Persian cat's got both of my baby beefsteaks down the floor, and he is going at them. Well, I just go berserk, and I start chasing this cat. And meantime, when I finally catch a cat, I throw cat steaks and everything right out in the yard, you know. But in the meantime, the insurance man made a swift exit. I didn't even know when he left. He got it. So a couple of days later, I went down to the cleaners, and I walked in, you know, and Earl said, how you doing? I said, good. I said, have you seen your insurance man? I said, I need to talk to him. And he said, yeah, he was by here a little while ago, and he said he decided that you weren't the one that needed the insurance. It was the cat. funny stories. There's so many funny stories. You could tell that when you're out there struggling and trying to make it, and it's comical now, but sometimes it was kind of pitiful at the time, you know. But
were you happy in those days, though? I mean, despite all the, you know, the beanie weenies and the cat.
Yeah, I was happy. I was happy. I was getting to perform. I was getting to play my music, and I was getting paid for it, no matter how little it was. But I was happy. You know, I really was.
Did you? I have to wonder, in that 10-year period or so in Knoxville, were you ever thinking, like, you know, Nashville's only 3 hours away. Maybe I should go over there and, you know, start bugging people.
You know, I never did think of that. I went to Nashville, I think, a couple times during that period. And I went down on Broadway, you know, and I saw Ernest Dubb Record Shop, and of course saw Tootsies and a few other things. But it never dawned on me to go down there and start beating on doors or anything. I felt like there were so many musicians down there already, I'd just be another face in the crowd, you know. But I felt like if somewhere along the line that I ever wrote a song or whatever, or the right person heard me, I may have a chance, you know. And as it turned out, that's kind of the way it happened. I wrote a song called Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. And not to be confused with the Neil Sedaka song, which he threatened to sue me, by the way, and I told him, you can't copyright a title.
As fate or luck or perhaps both would have it, a stockbroker in Nashville from Rogersville, a guy named Sam Kirkpatrick, heard Con Hunley singing at the Corner Lounge and said, hey, I can arrange a recording session for you. Con was naturally skeptical, but in this case, a show business promise was true, and he went down to Nashville and recorded 5 songs initially. Which songs did you record?
We recorded Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, Misery Loves Company, Columbus Stockade Blues, Loving You's a Habit I Can't Break. I mean, it was a blur, you know, all of a sudden. I mean, it went from playing the corner, all of a sudden, I'm in Studio RCA Studio B.
The great, great studio.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, did you just feel, just being in there, you know, must have felt incredible.
Oh, it was, well, let me tell you, when I went in there, I mean, and we had some of the same musicians played on Elvis' stuff. I had Grady Martin, you know, I mean, they're all these pickers, Pig Roberts, you know, but I mean, the A-list studio players is who we had. And they took me in there and they put me in the singer's booth. Well, it wasn't really a booth, just a little area. And put these headsets on me. And it was just surreal. I mean, all of a sudden, everything that I'd kind of dreamed about and hoped for seemed like was starting to take place. And I remember Larry, I can't think of his last name right now, the guitar player, anyway, he walked up to me when I was in place and we were getting ready to sing. He said, I want you to know you're standing right where Elvis stands when he sings. I thought, oh my God, I about flew apart, you know. So we recorded several songs, and it was quite an experience, and it started getting me some airplay and got people interested.
Were you nervous?
Extremely. Extremely nervous. It took me a while to calm down, and you go in and you know you're with all these A-list studio musicians, and you feel like you're just the absolute weakest person in the room. So it took me a while to calm down to where I could really get comfortable and sing, but we got through it. And of course, after the subsequent sessions were a little easier after that. Not to mention at that time I was partaking, so I might have had a little shot or something. But yeah, it calmed down and we got through it pretty well. It actually is pretty good stuff for the first. In fact, that's the name of the CD that. The first time from Studio B.
It's gonna take such a long, long time.
Do you get nervous in general? Do you when you play now? I can't imagine you being nervous, but some people do.
I'm a wreck.
Really?
Oh, I'm a wreck. I mean, before I go on stage, I'm a wreck. I'm just nervous. I'm pacing. I remember one time. I was out in Austin, Texas. I love golf, and so I got an opportunity to play in a lot of celebrity golf tournaments, you know, and not necessarily just to throw names out, but, you know, they had what they called the Ben Willie Darrell Golf Tournament out in Austin, Texas. It actually started the Woodlands in Texas, but anyway, it was in Austin. And Ben Willie Darrell was Ben Crenshaw, the golfer. Willie Nelson, and Darrell Royal, the iconic football coach, for Texas. But I remember my first time I went out there to perform, I'd gotten acquainted with Coach Royal pretty well. He and I just kind of hit it off, and he just loved my singing. So I was getting ready to go on stage. Well, I'm passing back and forth and back and forth, can't be still, you know. And he said, and I didn't know what this meant at the time, but I later found out. He said, I'm going to have to put a goat in there with you. And I thought, well, what does that mean? You know, well, I later found out that sometimes if you got a spirited horse that you put a goat or another animal in the pen or in the pasture field with them, and they become preoccupied with that other species of animal and they calm down. So that's kind of what it is. But I get nervous. I do until I sit down and I'm halfway through the first song. And then it kind of levels off for me, you know, and I get comfortable. But, yeah, I'm always kind of a wreck.
I never would imagine that just from watching you perform. I just don't see any evidence of it.
Well, I've learned to disguise it, you know. But I still get nervous. And I guess, I don't know, maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, I don't know, it's just the way it is.
Con Hunley didn't play a lot of organized sports as a kid, but he later discovered golf, which helped him out in a lot of ways. When did you first start playing golf?
I played my first game of golf when I was 27. I was having a tough time at that time. It was an outlet. It was something I needed to find another outlet. So I found out golf, you can't play it if you don't think about it, if you don't concentrate on what you're doing. And that's sort of how it started with me with golf, because it took my mind off of a lot of other things, you know. And it's really been good. I still play. I'm not good, but I told somebody the other day I'll never be able to play bad enough to make me want to quit. So, but it's really been instrumental. I mean, believe it or not, I don't know if you remember Martha Fogarty, who was with the Journal here in Knoxville for a long time. Between Martha and Bobby Denton, Martha used to get me a lot of print time in the journal. She thoroughly believed in me and my talent. And but Bobby Denton was a great friend. He was at WIBK, if I can say that.
Sure, absolutely.
But he was a great friend, and he got me invited to the Acrefroz Golf Tournament down at Chapel Hill, Tennessee, at the Henry Horton State Park. We went down and played golf, and of course, it was a bunch of musicians, a bunch of songwriters, and you can imagine it was a large time. A bunch of radio people, you know, kind of, you know, payback from Acrefroz, I guess, for all the people that had played and recorded and sold and all their songs, you know, because they had a heck of a catalog, as you well know. So I was invited to go down and play in the golf tournament, and after the afternoon of golf, that evening they would have a dinner, you know. Everybody would go eat, and then they had these... is it a courtesy room or whatever? Anyway, in the inn there was a huge room, and they would have guitar pulls. And so I went to the guitar pull, and I mean, I walked in, the first person I saw was Chet Atkins. You know, I got, oh God, here he is in the flesh. And of course, he played some, and Wayne Carson, he was a great songwriter. You know, Dale Reeves, there's just a lot of people, songwriters in that room sitting around, you know, and of course they all, bunch of guitars and what have you, and people would sing their songs, and, you know, pass the guitar around, somebody else sing a song, it's just unbelievable. I'm sitting there, you know, and just big-eyed, you know, in awe of everything. And Bobby, who'd probably had a pop or two by that time, he said, "Hey, God, won't you sing one?" And I said, "No, Bob, I don't." "Oh, come on, you sing. What are you doing?" You know, and well, my heart went from about 60 beats a minute to 160 beats. I thought, "Oh, my God, what am I going to do?" And he said, "Here, get this guitar." Well, it was Chet's guitar, you know, and I'm looking at this guitar, and I'm looking at Bobby, and I'm just looking around and thought, what am I going to do? And I mean, I was scared to death. And so I got the guitar, and I think I sang the old George Jones song, "She Thinks I Still Care." And I just closed my eyes, you know, like I was at the corner or at the Village Barn, and I sung it just the way I felt at that moment. And I got a great response. Sang another song or two, and the next thing I know, there's a lady in the audience, in the guitar pool. Her name was Bonnie Rasmussen. She was the publicity director for Warner Brothers.
Needless to say, she was impressed and spread the word around Warner Brothers. They were impressed. They chartered a plane, came all the way to Knoxville just to go see Con Hunley at the Village Barn. And there they were, checking him out, doing what he had always done, killing it every single night.
Yeah, I just did what I did. I thought, you know, if I could close my eyes and sing from my heart the way I did there, and she felt it, or they felt it, why would I won't change anything? So I just, it was a Saturday night, and it was the Village Barn, and I was going to sing just like I did every Saturday night. I was going to put my heart and soul into it and let it fall, let whatever, you know, happen. But, yeah, it was quite an experience. And, yeah, but within a couple of weeks, I got the offer. But that, you know, what's odd about it is I got offers from five major labels within about a 3-week period once it started happening. You know, word gets on the street down there, you know, and I never will forget Chet Atkins called the barn because he's wanting me to sign with RCA. In hindsight, I probably should have. That's another whole story. He calls the barn, and the lady at the front desk at the barn takes the call, and she says he's on stage right now. I said he'll be on break at blah, blah, blah. we called back, and she told me when I walked out, she said, Chet Atkins called, and he's wanting to talk to you. And I said, yeah, right. Yeah, right, Chet Atkins. Well, sure enough, I'm hanging out there in the foyer, and all of a sudden the phone rings, and she answers. She says, Con, here, it's Chet Atkins. I got on fire. I said, who is this? I said, I don't hear none of this Chet Atkins. You can imagine what I said. I said, who is this really? He said, Con, it's Chet. I said, really? He said, yeah, it's Chet Atkins. And, man, my heart felt, you know, I just thought, good God Almighty, here's one of my heroes, biggest heroes of all time. And he said he wanted to set up a meeting with me, talk to me about signing with RCA. And I did, in fact, meet with him at RCA, and we talked about it. And they weren't offering much in the way of a signing bonus or anything like that. And of course, I was broke. And then Warner Brothers had just started their country division, and they were throwing money at it like crazy. And they threw, you know, a pretty good chunk of change at a broke country boy. And I took it. But sometimes I think about it in hindsight, which it's okay to look at, but don't stare at it, you know, in the rearview mirror. But probably been better off I'd have signed with the RCA, but because Chet, you know, kind of kindred souls, being from East Tennessee, him being from Luttrell, all my family being from Sharp Chapel in Luttrell, Tennessee, in that area. But as they say, I wound up signed with Warner Brothers and had a pretty good run.
When you look back at it now, like when you look back from hindsight, what do you feel like about that? Particular period, like say the next 4 or 5 years, when it must have just seemed like you're on a rocket just taking
absolutely.
Off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't know if I could keep up. Yeah, I went from the Village Barn and the Corner Lounge, Eagles Club, to playing everywhere. You know, I mean, they spent a lot of money doing what they call showcases. They took me to Hollywood, you know, and introduced me out there around to everybody. I played the Palomino. When I get there, Johnny and June are there. I mean, a bunch of movie stars and other recording artists. Emmylou Harris was there, you know. And I mean, I'm walking out there. And of course, I just do my thing, you know. But it seemed like it was at rocket speed. It was going pretty quick.
How do you feel about those first few albums that came out?
You know, there's a lot of give and take when you first start out. I mean, you're young. As I mentioned, I was a country kid from East Tennessee. So I didn't know all the ropes. I didn't know all the publishing ploys and things that go on regarding records. You know, I mean, I cut some songs that I didn't particularly like because my producer or a certain publisher would say, well, we're going to give you this song, but you have to cut this song too. And I thought, well, I don't particularly like that song. Well, that didn't fly too well. So you kind of had to learn to go along and get along, you know.
Did any of those songs become hits, like the ones that you didn't like as much or not at all?
Not really. Okay. Not really. I was always able to kind of pick out the songs that fit me and fit my voice. And you know as well as I do, if your heart's not in a lyric, I mean, people can tell in New York second that it's not there, you know. So, but I always tried to pick songs that I felt and that appealed to me, and that I felt like I could perform in a way that would move or, you know, something in another person.
And then, I'm sure you have your favorites, and your fans have your favorites, because I love looking on YouTube. There's some people out there actually spinning the albums, you know. you know, there's videos of people spinning albums and talking about. this one I listened to get me through my divorce. And I mean, the songs each can be so special to an individual person. But is there one or two to you that just have something extra?
If you're talking just from straight lyrics, No Relief in Sight, What's New With You, those are great songs. But, you know, like I said, Weekend Friend, I think it's just a feel-good song, you know. Friday night don't come soon enough. Fortunate in that I had a lot of people who were a lot of great writers in Nashville that believed in me and would give me their top drawer stuff, you know. I mean, I remember one time we were recording at Columbia, I was in with Nora Wilson, who signed me to Warner Brothers, you know, who turned out to be one of my lifelong greatest friends. He's like a brother to me, and I just lost him, unfortunately. But we were recording, and Nora was kind of like me, you know. I mean, we kind of had the same background, and he liked kind of funky stuff, you know, and then he liked heartfelt country blues type stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we were recording in Columbia one day, and in walks Larry Gatlin, and I'm looking at him, you know, and I said, what's this all about? And he said, I just wrote a song for you. And I'm going, Larry Gatlin wrote a song for me? You know, I'm thinking that to myself. And Norrell said, and we're in the middle of a overdub session. And he said, I want you to hear it. So Norrell says, okay, play it. So he played it for us, and it was a song called Doctor, It Ain't No Better. The pain still comes and goes, and straight to my heart. And when I heard it, I loved it. Nora said, we'll be cutting that this afternoon. So you just never know how things are going to work out. But there's a lot of songs that I've loved and loved to perform over the years. They all mean something to me, and hopefully they mean something to the people who listen to them and take them to heart. As long as they don't play them backwards and come up with some kind of crazy.
Well, speaking of crazy, I'd Rather Be Crazy.
Yeah.
I always felt that's a great song. Yeah. And the way you sing that one, and I don't know if you feel the same way about it, but to me, the way you sing that song, man, it's like the way you bend the notes and the phrasing, it's just like, dang, you know.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, it has to hit me in the heart, in here, you know, inside my soul. And you know, you go through times in your life and everything's not perfect. I mean, you're going to get your heart broken. And you're lucky if once it's broken, it's not just trampled on, you know. You're lucky if that don't happen. And so some of these songs were recorded during some of those times, and you know, like you said, I'd Rather Be Crazy Than Out of Her Mind, and that was one of those songs. And but I loved them all, and I still love them all, and I still sing them all, and thank God I can still perform them in the same keys that I did when I recorded them, and so
wow.
I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, because your range, like there's songs where you hit just like some unbelievable low notes, and then you finish in a falsetto, and for me as a singer, I'm not a singer, but for me
yes you are.
Well, I make noises with my mouth,
but no.
But as someone who appreciates a song and a really great singer, you have that unbelievable combination of the skill to hit the notes and make them do what you want, but the soul to deliver the message of the lyrics. And for me, most singers for me can't do both. You know, you're one or the other, or, you know, pretty good at both or terrible at either. But in your case, you've got this ability to really bring that soul in it, but the chops to hit those notes and things.
Thank you very much for that. That coming from you, that means a lot to me. But I don't think I've ever sung a song the same way twice. You know, certainly, I mean, I had people come up to me and say, they need to record you live. And I look at him like, what is it? Because you're different. It's better live. It's like the studio stifles you. And to some extent, it did, but it wasn't conscious on my part because we were told, or I was told early on, don't get too carried away, you know, because if you do, radio won't play it, or if you, you know. And I said, but that's the way I feel it. And they said, well, try to feel it a different way. And I said, but I can't, you know. But they said,
be less excited.
Yeah, be less excited. Be less emotional. Be less caring, okay? Be less engaged. No, I can't. If it's my feelings that I'm trying to project, how can I be less engaged, you know? In fact, when I signed with Emmy Records, that's when I had total and absolute freedom. And I took my own band, did my own sessions with my own band, and we arranged everything, and I did it the way they said, you just bring it to us when you get finished with it, which was a nice deal.
And you've re-recorded a lot of your songs.
Yeah, I did. I went back and we worked out a deal with Warner Brothers, and I was able to go back in and remaster some of those things. And I had an album, you know, after signing with Warner Brothers, I signed with MCA, and I was with them, and I had, you know, half a dozen songs or so on MCA, and then the Jim Fogle song got axed, and when he got axed, a bunch of artists got axed as well, and I was one of them. And then he wound up at Capitol. So then they signed me to Capitol, and I went over there and had four or five songs in the can. I had one song that they couldn't kill. It's called What in the World Am I Going to Do About You, which later turned out to be a monster hit for Reba. But radio loved it. They couldn't kill it. And, of course, I was, you know, the same thing happened at Capitol. It happened to MCA. And so I was part of the, you know, process where you're without a label. And I thought, well, I'll just go home because, you know, I've got enough history, I've got enough songs out, and people know me well enough, I'll get another deal, you know, and that didn't happen. And that was a tough time, but it's something else. But, you know, we came back and did an album called Lost and Found. And that Lost and Found is a combination of the six songs or seven songs with MCA and the songs from Capitol Records. And it's a pretty good album, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so it's their lost, not mine. I got the songs.
She's getting in late once again. She don't know I know. But I love her enough, I just won't bring it up. Am I crazy or madly in love? My friends say I'm crazy, but I'm not so sure. But they never slept with their arms around. Us all a little crazy sometimes, but I'd rather be crazy than out of her mind.
And you're still performing today, and you know, I got to see you play with Mick Harrison down there at the Relics Theater. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about? Because that's kind of, in a way, it's an unlikely pair.
Oh, absolutely.
How did that come about?
Well, your friend and mine, and everybody's in town and knows anything about music and anything else, is Wayne Bledsoe. I mean, he came at me out of the blue. And he said, you know, Con, he said, I got this friend of mine. He said, I've been thinking, you know. And he's going to do the Drew Fest at the Relics.
Wayne Stock for the Love of Drew.
I mean, Wayne Stock, that's
right. Wayne Stock for the Love of Drew, yeah.
Yeah. So he said, I got an idea. He said, I would like for you to come play it, but I want you to, he said, I'd like for you to play it with Mick Harrison. And I said, okay, we'll try that. You know, I didn't know that much about Vic or whatever. And one word led to another, and so I talked to Mick, and we had a little session with him and the high score over here at the, what they call it, the Bird's Nest.
Birdhouse.
Birdhouse.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Fort Gill.
And we go up there, and I thought, well, this is pretty good. And it's just so raw, you know, it was just raw. And of course, the more I got to know Mick, the better I liked him. He was just a heck of a great guy. And writes some really good stuff, and so we went and did the Relics, and it turned out really great, and I enjoyed it, and we've done a couple of things together since then. They played the Corner Lounge a lot long ago, and so I went and sat in with them again and played, and so I really like those guys. I like them a lot, and they're great players, and I love their approach.
So what's next for you?
Well, let's see. Tomorrow I'm playing golf. No, I'm going to go down next week, and we're going to be taping some diner shows and what have you. And so I'm looking forward to that. And just a little bit here and there, nothing big, you know. Don't stay too busy. If it's a short trip and the money's fairly good, I can pay my guys good, then I'll go do it. If not, I'll just stay home.
You still love it, though, don't you?
I do. I love it. The minute I sit down and get started, it's like 1961 all over again.
One of the strangest things I uncovered in your bio was this was after you had sort of kind of retreated back to Knoxville and were taking that break for a while. And you got asked to play Hillary Clinton's birthday. I mean, that's another one of those things just like...
Yeah, what?
How did that happen?
Well, it really... Jason D. Williams, who is who's played around Knoxville several times, who to me is as good or better than Jerry Lee Lewis, and he does that same, you know, rockabilly piano. Chelsea and Bill, you know, he was from Arkansas, and so they knew him, and so they were going to throw Hillary Clinton a surprise birthday party, and so Chelsea wanted Jason D to come and play. Well, Jason D and I had become friends through Ray Hand, who's Ray and Lucy Hand, who are friends of mine, and so. When they got a hold of Jason D, Jason called Ray. Ray called me and said, would you like to go play the White House? And I said, sure. It's sort of like one of those Chet Atkins moments. Yeah, okay, yeah, right. And he said, no, I'm serious.
Yeah, send Air Force One down for me.
Yeah, huh? Yeah. Send it down. Come to find out, he was not kidding. And so we went to the White House, flew up there and went to the White House, went in, went through the security thing and all that stuff. And I don't know what kind of background check they did, but it must have been minimal because we went right in. But I'm talking about myself, not everybody else, but we had a great time. It was kind of a, what do you call it, masquerade kind of birthday party. But I'll tell you what really surprised me about that whole deal was what a bubba Bill Clinton was. I mean, unbelievable. We played and we sang, you know. And then so toward at the end of the night, I started doing some old blues stuff, you know. And he said, wait just a minute. So he goes running upstairs and comes back down with his sax. And he starts playing sax with us while we were playing. And that was, I sat there and talked to him. It was like us just sitting here having a conversation, and we got talking about it, you know, his sinuses. I mean, just everyday stuff, and it was unbelievable. And so when it was over, there was people meandering around. Gladys Knight was there. You know, there's several people, and they were meandering around. Well, I got looking around, you know, old country boy wandering around the White House, and I saw this door, and I went down this door, and went down about a flight of stairs, half flight of stairs, you know, and there's all these pipes and tunnels and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I'm thinking, that's unbelievable. So I'll take a few more steps, and all of a sudden I heard, "Can I help you?" I turned around and looked, and it was Secret Service. He said, "Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to go back upstairs." I said, "Yes, sir." And I turned around and walked back upstairs. But it was fun. But he couldn't have been more genuine. Hillary, you know, she was a little standoffish, not bad. But, God, he was just like a good old boy, you know, put them pickup truck and here we go and take the dogs and go fishing.
Well, at least you didn't go up on the roof like Willie Nelson
did. No, I'm surprised Willie didn't fly off. Yeah, it was a neat little deal. I mean, not everybody can say they played the White House, you know. And there's been so many firsts in my life. I remember, you know, we were talking about the golf tournament a while ago for Ace Miller and the Golden Glove charities that we worked so hard for when John Tate, rest his soul, when he won the heavyweight championship. I was fortunate enough to go to South Africa and sing the anthem for that event, and it was the first integrated sporting event to be held in Pretoria, South Africa, and I sang the anthem for that, and that's something I will never forget. It was unbelievable, 93,000 people. And it was kind of scary, but and it was, you know, it hadn't been that long since the riots and everything in Soweto, so there was a little tension there, you know, and but it came off really well.
And you sang "Satisfied Mind" with Porter Wagner.
I did.
That to me is, I mean, well, I don't know. That's hard to say one or the other, but that to me was. I mean, that's one of my all-time favorite songs.
Yeah.
And
I loved it. I loved it, and I kind of got, you know, radio kind of admonished me about recording it, but it didn't matter. You know, I recorded it. I recorded it because I loved what it had to say, and to have him to come on and, you know, and sing on it with me. Well, you know, Con, you know, I mean, it's just so good, and he was always such a nice guy.
You know, Con, the wealthiest person is a pauper at times. Compared,
I mean, there's so many of the people that I admired that were on the Grand Ole Opry that I was able to get acquainted with and able to perform with it. You know, I remember listening to the Grand Ole Opry when I was a kid. My grandmother had a battery-operated radio, and she lived in Union County. And they had a wire from this radio as an antenna and had taken it up this big old tall tree so they could get the Grand Ole Opry. And to be able to hear those people, and then at some point in time being able to meet them, you know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, when I stop and think about 4412 Mack Lane in northeast Knox County, I mean, something else.
Well, it's good to meet that kid that grew up there.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, sometimes I don't think about it much. I always thought of myself just another guy. And that's the way I like it, you know. As I mentioned earlier, it's not about spotlight or flame with me. I'm just thankful I've got the talent and I was able to do what I can do. But in the end, I don't want to be anything other than just calling a good old boy. And I hope that's the way they take me.
Well, I guess that wraps up this edition of Raised in Knoxville. I'd like to thank Con Hundley for being so generous with his time. I learned a lot, and I have a lot more questions. So maybe I'll get to bug him again at a future date. And I guess this wraps up the Raised in Knoxville podcast for now. Where are we going next? What are we doing? I don't know. But know that East Tennessee is full of stories waiting to be told, and we're going to go out and find them for you. I'm Todd Steed for WUOT.